On October 15th, 2022, Tube Factory Art Space hosted a reading of essays from the new book, Indiana Waterways, The Art of Conservation. The project, organized by artist Avon Waters, includes both the work of Hoosier plein air painters and writers of the passion for our state's waterways. This is a recording of the event made possible with support from Indiana Humanities. An exhibition of the artwork is up at the Indiana State Museum through December 11th, 2022.
My name is Avon Waters, and I want to thank you for coming here today. Project today is in collaboration with many people, Art Nature Consortium is the nonprofit that is putting on the program or the project called Indiana Waterways, The Art of Conservation. Now, let me give you some background before we do our readings. We have essayists here who are going to be doing readings for you. And I want to give you some background about how this this collaboration all started with ANC and the five artists. When COVID hit, anybody remember COVID-19? Anybody remember that? All right. And what were we? We were stuck in our houses. Okay. By the summer and spring of 2020, COVID-19 had shut down many of the public-facing events. And I'm one of these Indiana plein air artist painters. They call them IPAPA. And we always had events once or twice a month. And our big event that draws hundreds of people in the spring was canceled. Then the next one was canceled. And pretty soon then we got to get out a little bit in the summer. But then they started saying, COVID's coming back. COVID's coming back. You're going to be stuck inside again. So four of my artist friends and I got together and decided, okay, we don't know how long we're going to be stuck inside, how many things are going to be canceled. So what we did as artists, we said, you know, as individuals, we can go out and we can paint. And no matter whether we get out and the public facing events come back or it opens up next year or whatever, we can develop some sharing online, which anybody here share online? Anybody know what Zoom meetings are now? Okay, yeah, all right. So we took some of that, but we still wanted to paint outside. I mean, we're outdoor painters. So we got together in the fall of 2020 and decided to do this art project. And then when we're sitting there, it's like, well, let's more than have one exhibit. Let's see if we can get a touring of these art pieces. Let's do 100 art pieces. Then it's like, let's not just have a book of art. Let's find a way to add writing to it. And let's make it more than just visual art. Let's make it literary arts. And so that's how the introduction of this publication that you see on the back there, this book that's been published. It has the 100 paintings that, by the way, 60 of them open up today at the Indiana State Museum. And that exhibit opens today and goes through December 11th. And then once it closes, we move it to Fort Wayne Museum of Art. And all 100 pieces will be in through January through March. Then it goes to Miniaturista Museums and Gardens. And if you aren't familiar with Miniaturista is a museum that is associated with several mansions that used to be the Ball family. Anybody do canning? Canning, you've ever heard of Ball jars? Well, that's the family from ages ago that foundation now funds many, many art events and helps with Miniaturista and the community around Muncie. Then it goes down to Southern Indiana. We hope to the New Harmony Museum or gallery, which is the Hoosier Salon in New Harmony, the little boot of Indiana. But this today is the focused on the writers and a chance for them to do readings from their essays. There's three essays. And when we got together as artists, we said we all had different styles. And So we wanted the writing not to be like somebody else continued chapter 2 and chapter 3. We wanted the writing to be different genres also. So what we found is we found some environmental writers that were able to fit that bill. And I will give a longer introduction to each of them, but if you would raise your hand, I would appreciate it. We have Jerry Sweeten back there, Dr. Jerry Sweeten. And we have Jason Goldsmith here, and we have Carson Gerber over here. And each of them did an essay for this book. And what I want you to realize is that when you go to the cereal aisle, you know, there's not one cereal there. There's like many. And we all have different tastes. And so this was our approach with the art. The art is all about Indiana rivers. And we wanted to make the writing become about the conservation of those rivers. And we use the art kind of like clickbait. Anybody heard of clickbait? Well, we're going to use the art like clickbait or eye candy to get people interested. And then they'll learn about these essays on conservation. And each one of these essays focuses on something different. We tried, one of the genres we had is reportage, which is the traditional, the person who likes the cereal very plain. I want my cornflakes, I want my milk, I want my sugar. Give me the facts is reportage. Then Dr. Sweeten, he did this wonderful piece that uses the memoir format. Now, as soon as I told you that he was Dr. Jerry Sweeten and a biologist, you thought, uh-oh, I'm back into my college biology lecture. No, you're going to be in for a treat. And Jason is a wonderful creative writer, and so he did a creative nonfiction piece. So, today's event, like I said, is made possible by the Indiana Humanities. And for those of you that have been around a while, you may remember the Indiana Humanities Council. So Indiana Humanities is providing a grant for this. And for the entire project, we relied on many grants, one of which was the Isaac Walton League of the Indiana Division, and another is the Indiana Arts Commission. So those grants have helped us do this, but more importantly, there's probably almost 100 individual people who gave small donations and large donations up to $1,000 each, which also helped make all this possible. So I would be amiss if I didn't give Susan Neville from Butler. Give her a hand, yes. I knew Susan from my master's project. I had gone to one of her readings and a workshop. And so when I needed writers, I contact Susan, and then she says, you know, I can write a grant to the Indiana Humanities and maybe help. And she did. And so that's why we're here today. So thank you very much, Susan. Let's begin with our first essayist. Let me, what I'll do is after each essay is done, they'll have a seat and I'll come up and introduce and give you a little bit more detail about the next essayist. Our first essayist is Jason Goldsmith. He's the author of many creative nonfiction stories, as I said, many focused on nature. He has been a professor at Butler University for the past 17 years. And before that, he had an opportunity to work with industries that gave him a very unique perspective on the challenges to conserve our natural resources. So let's give Jason a warm welcome and we'll begin.
So I'm not from Indiana, unlike most of the people here. I moved here in 2005 to take a job at Butler. So I need to give you a little bit of background about the essay because it's very long and I'm only excerpting a very small piece of that for this reading today. So I had been here about 5 or 6 years, and you know, you would think in that amount of time you would feel at home a little bit. You would begin to put down roots, but that hadn't been happening for me, despite the fact that I really liked my job. I had purchased a home. My wife and I had had our first child. I was still feeling very unsettled. So I came up with this plan. Nature had always been really important to me. And I came up with this plan that I was going to go out into the natural world and kind of understand this place, Indiana, and then I would feel at home. I would be able to put down some roots. I typically like high places. I like going up into the mountains. I've lived in mountainous areas for most of my life, but Indiana is flat. There aren't many mountains here. So I found myself for the first time in my life drawn to water. And what I came up with was this plan to paddle the length of the White River. I said, oh, I can do this. How hard can it be? It's really hard, really difficult. Carson, I think I noticed in your bio that you have sort of floated the entire Wabash River. That's an undertaking. So I'll let you know that I did not paddle the length of the White River. I got on the water a total of 7 times. I covered about 81 miles on the river, which is only about 20% of the White River's 362-mile length. This was 10 years ago I decided to do it. So the project kind of just fizzled and collapsed. And when the opportunity came to write about rivers and Indiana waterways, I thought, ah, yes, now I know what I want to write about. I want to reflect on the folly of this project and why it didn't work, what I've learned about nature, and how my relationship to the natural world has changed in the interim, how I've grown as a person. The essay is a braided essay. There are lots of different parts. Some of it is more lyrical and creative. Some of it is more reportage, as it were. But it was really important to me to address the troubling social history of our waterways. And since Monday was Indigenous Peoples Day, I've decided for this event to read a few sections about the First Nations that had inhabited Indiana before European arrival. It may seem disjointed in a couple of places because these are sections that come from different areas in a 40-page essay. So, I realize now that my wish to paddle the river's length was repeating a colonial settler understanding of the land as natural, unpopulated, wild. Only today, as then, the land wasn't unknown. I was simply ignorant of its history. The White River was particularly valuable to the Adena and Hopewell cultures. It was a source of food, travel, and trade. Long before the arrival of European settlers, sophisticated cultures developed here in equilibrium with the land. Extensive trade networks stretched from the Great Lakes to the Gulf of Mexico and along the Atlantic coast to the deserts. Although it's impossible to identify a direct line of descent between these woodland period cultures and the named tribes that followed them, indigenous peoples occupied the area we now call Indiana for centuries before the arrival of Europeans. Following the end of the Beaver Wars, when the Iroquois had sought to expand their control of the fur trade into the Great Lakes and Ohio Valley, the Miami returned to Indiana around 1700, settling along the Wabash and its many tributaries. Situated at the confluence of the Maumee and St. Joseph Rivers, Kekiyanga, present-day Fort Wayne, was their largest capital village for generations and a strategic portage connecting Lake Erie to the Mississippi. But the river did more than just provide physical sustenance. It formed the core of Miami cultural identity. Their origin story begins, at first, the Miami came out of the water. The river thus functions as a spiritual and formative marker of tribal identity, closely linking the people to the river's life-giving waters. As Miami historian Scott Shoemaker puts it, the river is the narrative of the people. Although the dominant group in central and northern Indiana, the Miami were not alone. The land we now call Indiana land of the Indians, was populated by numerous Native American tribes during the period of European contact. Miami, Wee, Piankasha, Potawatomi, Kickapoo, Shawnee, and more coexisted. The land did not belong to the people. Rather, the people belonged to the land. Each nation flourished within a central region surrounded by permeable and often overlapping peripheries. Less essential to a tribe's sustenance, these peripheries were negotiated through intermarriage and trade that bound the tribes in relationships of reciprocity. In general, neighbors were relatives, and the tribes used kinship terms to refer to them. Warfare, when it occurred, was often ritualized to minimize the loss of life. The Miami invited the Lenni Lenape, the original people, to settle along the White River's banks around 1770. The Lenape had been forced out of their traditional territory on the mid-Atlantic coast by successive waves of settlers. And although their time in Indiana would be curtailed by further Euro-American incursion, about 2,000 Lenape established 14 villages on the West Fork of the White River. Curtis Zuniga, who is the tribal operations manager of the Delaware tribe, has noted how through these moves, water always remained central to Lenape tribal identity. And here I'm quoting him. "A lot of our moves pursuant to treaties and agreements, we always sought out the water first. That's part of the enduring legacy of the Lenape people, that wherever they did move, they began to have an affinity with, a relationship with, the river." With 14 chiefs and a great man, the Lenape had the largest presence at the signing of the Treaty of Greenville, the 1795 treaty here, which opened the Ohio Valley to white settlers while reserving most of Indiana for Native Americans. In ceding the lands of Ohio and establishing the Greenville line, the tribes sought to protect themselves from further encroachment. But it didn't work out that way. Border conflicts and illegal settlement by squatters and speculators continued. Once established, these illegal communities would call on the federal government to protect them from reprisals by the tribes, who sought to maintain legitimate control of land long theirs and designated so by treaty. In response, the government would send irregular militias and federal troops to violently suppress resistance. The historical record shows that these troops indiscriminately slaughtered women and children. They burned indigenous villages and fields. What Greenville really marked was the beginning of a series of treaties and land cessions designed to drive the indigenous peoples off their lands by any means necessary. George Washington expressed this scorched earth policy when commanding one of his generals, quote, "to lay waste all the settlements around, that the country may not be merely overrun, but destroyed. You will not by any means listen to any overture of peace before the total ruin of their settlements is effected," end quote. And I could repeat numerous instances of our presidents and leaders expressing this kind of sentiment. We have never truly come to terms with the brutal legacy of settler colonialism, a policy of genocide and dispossession pursued by a government eager to take indigenous land at any cost. It is a legacy that continues in our ongoing treatment of Native Americans to this day. But settler colonialism did more than just remove people from the land. It fundamentally altered the relationship between people and non-human others. The removal of the Miami, the Potawatomi, the Lenape, and other tribes had a drastic impact on human-environmental relations. Once understood as a shared, sacred space, the land became a discrete commodity to be bought, sold, and transformed. For the Miami, the land was a partner, a gift from the Creator that informed who they were, shaping their history and cosmology. It was the place they buried their ancestors. It sustained life. It was land held in common. Throughout Indiana, the Miami established summer villages along streams and rivers where they planted crops in the fertile soil of floodplains and had access to the flora and fauna of a complex riparian ecosystem. They lit seasonal fires, clearing the undergrowth through prescribed burns, working in concert with the land. In contrast, the Euro-American arrivals ignored fundamental interspecies relationships and failed to respect the integrity of the ecosystems they entered. The land was cleared, turned, and tilled. The forest was cut down and wetlands were reclaimed to create arable agricultural lands. Streams were channelized. Trees were cleared along the rivers. Without shade, the water temperature increased. The banks, no longer secured by roots, began to erode. Sediment loads increased, covering mussel beds and fish spawning grounds. Animal and agricultural waste from tilled fields entered the waterways, decreasing the quality of aquatic habitats. Biological diversity collapsed as numerous species were extirpated. Mills and slaughterhouses dumped waste material. Sewage from expanding towns made its way into feeder streams and creeks. Prior to the arrival of settlers, the White River ran clean through mostly hardwood forest. The Miami called it Wapahani, white sands, for the sparkling limestone visible through its clear waters. After just one generation of settlers, the White River was muddied. In those 100 years, settlers transformed the landscape that had taken 10,000 years to develop. In 1850, Governor Joseph Wright proudly boasted to the General Assembly, quote, "We are an agricultural people. Our climate, soil, and situation make it so," end quote. He was wrong. We made it so. We would be wrong to think of the indigenous peoples as historic presences. Despite the removals, native peoples remained on these lands. The Miami families of Richardsville and Godfrey have maintained a continuous presence here, while many descendants of those removed have returned to the area. What would it mean to connect with the indigenous communities living here now? To start, we would need to acknowledge a history of injustice, as well as the social and economic structures that perpetuate those injustices. This is difficult, but necessary. Settler colonial logic has limited our understanding of the river. Now, more than ever, we need to learn from those who know the land as something more than just a commodity. Those for whom the land is an essential part of their very being. Even after all these years, Shoemaker attests, quote, "The rivers continue to play an important role in the lives and indigenous identity of the contemporary Indiana Miami people," end quote. The Chickasaw novelist Linda Hogan is right when she says, "Indian people must not be the only ones who remember the agreement with the land, the sacred pact to honor and care for the life that in turn provides for us. But any vision for the future of Indiana's waterways must include a commitment to the original inhabitants who lived and who continue to live within their watersheds. We need to collaborate with indigenous communities, to partner with Black communities as well. In turning to indigenous ways of knowing and being, though, we must be mindful not to repeat the pattern of appropriation and dispossession that has long characterized settler-native relations." That's not easy, by the way. The ecological crisis is an incontrovertible fact. But it is also a crisis of culture, and of Western culture specifically. In this sense, we can understand the crisis as embedded in the stories we tell, the art we make, the songs we sing. Can we tell new stories that open different ways of knowing the world? Is it possible to paint ecologically? And what might that even mean? If the point of this waterways project is to highlight ecological peril and the significance of waterways to our communities, we need to do more than just represent pretty scenes. We look at a work of art framed and isolated as a discrete object, and we appreciate its beauty. We might even yearn to visit the place depicted. But if we simply attend to its surface, the immediate moment of encounter, us in the art, we will fail to appreciate the land represented as anything more than mere scenery. What if instead we were to see each painting as one instant in a passage of time, a single frame of a moving picture? This would be to enter a different relationship to the land, to adopt a different way of seeing and knowing. What if we were to treat the work like a river, to wonder what lies below the surface? Moreover, to consider the river not as a border or an edge, but as the center of a watershed, a gathering place toward which an entire region pours itself. I wonder if this might be a step toward indigenizing our thinking. An insufficient step, of course, but a step nonetheless. To take this step would be to recognize our moment as but one in a long history, to acknowledge and account for that history. I think my impulse was right, to seek the river to know the place, but the way I went about it was wrong. My desire to paddle the length of the river was colonial, a way to map unfamiliar territory, to tame the unknown. We've practiced this approach to great devastation. These days, I want a different relationship to the river. What I'm trying to say, I think, is that we can never really know the thing itself. It will forever be other. And really, a river doesn't need to be known. It simply is. We need to sit with the river, not to discover some deep truth about it, but rather to recognize that the river is never alone. Only then can we situate the river and the tree and the heron, ourselves, our neighbors, within the world of which each one is an indelible part. We need to see relationships rather than objects. But modern life is busy. Burdened with worries and anxieties, we turn to yoga or meditation to still our minds and connect with the present moment. And this is good practice. There is a cost, though, to living too much in the moment. In so doing, we fail to recognize that moment in its unfolding as extending beyond our present. Our presence. We must begin to cultivate a different sense of time, to realize that each moment is but one of a multitude inextricably woven together. Perhaps our understanding can take the shape of the river, ever-changing, fed by innumerable streams, drifting through different terrains and communities, shaped by and shaping the land, its lazy riffles and surging rapids, its hidden depths, the play of light and shadow across its surface. Thank you.
I'd like you also to know that Jason is also the program director of the Vivian S. Delbrook Visiting Writer Series at Butler University, where he also teaches courses on literature, art, and the environment. Our next essayist, I discovered, had an intense interest in the environment after reading a story he wrote about an Environmental Protection Agency report. That report stated that many of Indiana's waterways are among some of the worst in the nation. Some are in such bad condition that many are not safe for human contact. Yet, our children and others play in them all the time. Carson Gerber is a nationally recognized award-winning journalist. He's currently covering the state issues for a newspaper chain called CNHI. Carson has worked in Indiana and Ohio for more than a decade, reporting on local topics and environmental impact of industry on Hoosier communities. Please welcome and give a hand for Carson Gerber.
Thanks, Avon. Yeah, I was pretty excited when you reached out to me about doing this. I've been an avid canoeer my whole life, art lover, and I do environmental reporting, so this is right up my alley. But my essay is kind of a good follow-up to Jason's. Him looking back at sort of the devastation caused by colonialism on the environment. My essay is looking at the Isaac Walton League, which was established to combat just that. I think Avon wanted the essay because Isaac Walton was a huge sponsor of the project here. But digging into it, they're a pretty fascinating group. This is 100 years for them. They were founded in 1922. So they've been doing this for 100 years, and they've really done a lot. I don't think they get as much credit as they should for their conservation work. I think a lot of people know them as sort of skeet shooting, fishing, sort of a more outdoor recreation group, but they've done a lot of really important conservation work. So my essay is looking at their history, sort of what they've done, and it's not super long, so I'm going to read the whole thing, if you can bear with me, and I'll try to make it interesting. Indiana playing catch up in conservation efforts is the name of the essay here. The Grand Calumet River only takes a short 13-mile jaunt west from Gary before it empties into Lake Michigan through the Indiana Harbor and Ship Canal. But that short stretch of stream carries some of the most polluted water in the United States. Today, the river has been designated as a Great Lakes Areas of Concern under the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement, due in part to its fish consumption restrictions, beach closings, and fish and animal deformities. The river's pollution reached its pinnacle in the mid-20th century with steel mills, oil refineries, and other industrial factories flooding the waterway with millions of cubic feet of toxic sludge. The river's vibrant fish population of carp, northern pike, bluegill, and yellow perch virtually disappeared. Those that did survive are likely to have deformities, eroded fins, lesions, and tumors. It was the same story for lakes and rivers around the nation. In 1969, the Cuyahoga River in Ohio caught fire for the 13th time after decades of oil and debris buildup in the waterway. It wasn't the largest or most devastating fire on the river, but it captured the attention of the nation after Time magazine did an expose on the incident. Suddenly, the country's eye turned toward the decades of unnoticed pollution dumping into rivers and streams, especially those in highly industrial areas like the Grand Calumet River in Gary. In response, Congress took one of the most bold and sweeping steps toward conservation by passing the National Environmental Policy Act. It was signed into law on January 1st, 1970, and helped establish the Environmental Protection Agency that same year. But one conservation group didn't want the government to be the only ones keeping an eye on the health of the nation's waterways. For the Isaac Walton League of America, protecting rivers and streams was a duty of all its members and to all those who called America home. Congress passed its environmental policy in 1969. That same year, the Isaac Walton League started Save Our Streams, the only nationwide program training volunteers to protect waterways from pollution and collect water quality data that would be some of the first citizen-provided information to the EPA that it considered scientifically valid. The Isaac Walton League, one of the oldest conservation groups in the U.S., has spent the last 100 years fighting to protect the nation's waterways and sounding the alarm on environmental devastation happening across America. In fact, deteriorating water quality in lakes and rivers was the issue that brought 54 sportsmen to Chicago on January 14, 1922, who founded the group to protect the top fishing streams and rivers that were under the threat from industrial pollution. They named their new conservation group after Isaac Walton, the 17th century English author of The Complete Angler, the literary classic that praised the beauty and streams of Walton's homeland and documents the author's adventures teaching a novice fisherman about the sport and his philosophy about environmental stewardship. From the beginning, the Isaac Walton League made preserving America's rivers and streams its top priority. In 1927, zoologist and league member Henry Ward suggested to President Calvin Coolidge that the group could prepare a nationwide water quality survey. Coolidge commissioned the league to send questionnaires to health officials in all 48 states. It was the first national survey of its kind, and the results showed that sewage was responsible for 75% of the nation's water pollution because most sewer systems were not yet connected to any treatment facility. The study also determined the Midwest, Northeast, and California had the most polluted waterways. In response to the findings, seven states rapidly passed laws to address water pollution. The league used that momentum to make a national push over the next decade to build sewage treatment plants in every community. Local chapters took up the cause, which led to new treatment facilities in towns and cities around the U.S. The league's emphasis on first-person observation and hands-on advocacy led chapters in Maryland to start a program called Save Our Streams. They modeled it after the state's Adopt the Highway program, but instead of roads, members adopted a waterway. Volunteers reported water pollution, removed trash and debris, and educated the public about preventing pollution. In 1972, thanks in part to efforts from the league, Congress approved the Clean Water Act, which allowed the EPA to implement pollution control programs and enforce policies that made it illegal to discharge any pollutant from a point source unless a permit was obtained. The Isaac Walton League celebrated the sweeping policy changes brought on by the legislation and hailed the Clean Water Act as one of the crowning conservation achievements. But the group knew it could not depend only on the EPA to keep the nation's rivers safe. In 1973, the league adopted and developed national guidelines for Save Our Streams and asked every chapter and member to adopt and clean up local waterway. In 1975, to get the word out about the new program, the league's new Save Our Streams director, Dave Whitney, jumped aboard a converted mobile home dubbed the Water Wagon and traveled to every state in the contiguous U.S. His message was simple, quote, "Water is vital to our lives. You can't make any more of this stuff." In the mid-1980s, the group partnered with the Ohio Department of Natural Resources to develop a volunteer monitoring protocol to gauge a stream's health based on the presence of insects and other aquatic life. In 1990, the EPA approved the league's approach to ensuring scientifically valid data, making it one of the first such quality assurance plans to be approved by the agency. Save Our Streams gradually picked up steam in chapters across the nation, but it took the Indiana division longer than that to fully embrace the power of the program. After it launched, local chapters continued to work independently on their own water quality programs. In north central Indiana town of Argos, members started a fish hatchery program and donated their first fish to the state's hatchery system. Others organized annual river cleanups. Chapters in northwest Indiana continued to work to restore wetlands around the Kankakee River, which was home to the largest inland marsh in the U.S. before it was nearly all destroyed and turned into farm ground. Some chapters eventually did take up the Save Our Streams program, but it wasn't until the 1990s that state leaders made a concerted push to adopt the program across all of Indiana. Organizers called a meeting and appointed a committee chairman at each of the state's 28 chapters. Then they sent off volunteers to start teaching at schools and youth programs in their regions. One project guy taught students about watersheds, pollution sources, and stream ecology, and then helped them create their own science projects monitoring our river's biology and water quality. Another Save Our Streams booklet taught students how to do critter counts to identify the larvae of beetles, mayflies, worms, and other creatures to determine a stream's health. At one point, Save Our Streams was taught in every summer school class in the Indianapolis Public Schools District. Indiana's league division had consolidated the program, but that initial push gradually fizzled out in some chapters as they worked on their own projects or put more emphasis on the recreational activities, such as organizing skeet shooting and fishing tournaments. Since 2019, the National League and the State Division have sustained a prolonged push to reinvigorate the program. In 2021, the Indiana Division acquired 12 professional-grade kits to test water quality in lakes and rivers around the state. The kits cost several hundred dollars and include different kinds of nets, dip strips for chemical testing, and reference materials. All that information can now be found on a nationwide database created by the league called Clean Water Hub. It's a first of its kind of resource for water quality information from around the U.S. Members can submit current or historic data from testing kits, and all the information is publicly available using the interactive online map. In Indiana, more than 40 testing sites have been logged, most of which are along rivers and ditches in the Fort Wayne region. Data provided on the map through the Save Our Streams test kits plays a vital role in monitoring the state's waterways. The Indiana Department of Environmental Management only does site-specific testing on a fraction of the state's 62,550 miles of rivers and streams. Most water quality data used by the agency is derived from statistical calculations. Now, with more site-specific data provided by volunteers to supplement items testing, officials can more accurately shape Indiana's water quality programs and initiatives. And here's the last section called Adapting to a New Century. Since the Isaac Waltley of America was founded 100 years ago, Indiana's water quality has vastly improved. Fewer rivers are clogged with pollution and debris due to the EPA and IDEM actively enforcing clean water laws and fining those who violate them. Today, most Hoosiers don't give a thought to what's in their drinking water. But water pollution hasn't gone away. It's simply morphed into something more subtle and less conspicuous than the burning rivers and oil-soaked beaches of the 1960s. Today's threat is the runoff from tens of millions of acres of farms, suburban lawns, and parking lots in cities across America. And the new threat means a new approach to Save Our Streams, to the Save Our Streams program. Samantha Briggs, the league's clean water program director, says, "Success today and in the future will be defined by detecting and tackling this 21st century threat." In Indiana, one of the most pressing issues is curbing runoff from concentrated animal feeding operations, known as CAFOs, and fields that eventually flows into the Mississippi River. That runoff is full of nutrients that sucks oxygen out of water. Enough of it has now ended up in the Gulf of Mexico to create a 1.4 million acre environmental disaster called the Dead Zone that kills nearly all aquatic life there. And Indiana contributes about 11% of that fish killing runoff. Where exactly does that runoff come from in Indiana? That's what programs like Save Our Streams can help determine through volunteer testing and monitoring. Briggs saying, "If most streams in America are not regularly monitored, there is no way to detect these drastic pollution events. In other words, you don't know what you don't know." The Indiana Division also is getting back to the program's educational roots, teaching kids about what clean water actually means. Jim Sweeney, a member of the Spring Lake chapter and a national executive board member, has taken a unique approach by participating in canoe mobile events each year to show students the magic of macroinvertebrates. "The kids just eat that stuff up when you show them all those bugs," Sweeney said. "It's a good learning tool." The Isaac Walton League has spent the last century fighting and advocating for clean water, and the organization shows no signs of stopping. New initiatives like the Salt Watch program are getting members and everyday citizens to advocate for less road salt, which can create unhealthy water conditions for aquatic animals and end up in our drinking water. The league has also created a new Critter Creek app on phones to help kids and families identify the bugs and other creatures that indicate a healthy stream. It all stems from the vision laid out by the league's founders 100 years ago to protect the nation's waterways, woods, and wildlife. That vision included advocating for legislative changes, connecting Americans to the outdoors, and providing citizens with programs like Save Our Streams that turns data into action. Indiana's Save Our Streams director, Edward Wininski, said both the National League and the Indiana Division continue to implement that vision and advocate for changes to protect local waterways over the next century. After all, if conservation groups like the Isaac Walton League don't continue to raise the alarm, who will? Wininski saying, We're trying to bring that to the public, not in a radical way, but in a common sense way. It's a never-ending process. Just when we think we've crossed a bridge, so to say, we come up against another flooded stream. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, our last essayist, you're in for a treat. He's a great storyteller. Now he's shaking his head because it's like, oh, you've put the pressure on me here. A lot of you have probably restored a house or maybe worked on an old car or decided to renovate an older home and or even just decide to, you bought a Victorian home or a period home and wanted to put period furniture in it. And you spent several years looking to match all those things up with whatever age it was. My next essayist, imagine that the mental fortitude, if you've had that experience of restoring something or remaking something or trying to get period pieces, imagine the mental fortitude and determination that it takes to restore an entire river and improving the wildlife and the botany of thousands of square miles of Indiana River Basin. That has been the more than 20-year quest for our next reader, Dr. Jerry Sweeten. Dr. Sweeten taught biology at Manchester University, where he is professor emeritus of biology and environmental studies. He owns and operates today with his wife, Melinda, Ecosystems Connections Institute in Denver, Indiana. Please welcome Dr. Jerry Sweeten.
Thanks, Avon, and it's a pleasure to be here with you today. And first thing I'd like to do is to thank Avon. Avon has spent, I don't know how many hours, dysfunctional emails that I get once in a while trying to figure out what he's trying to say. And I think we owe him a round of applause for all of his work. Thank you. And the team. I mean, there's been a team of people. I know nothing happens in a vacuum, and everyone. And it's a real honor to even have been asked to write anything for a document like this. I'm out of my element. This is not usually the type of venue that I produce or to present data. But the other thing I think is really special about this book, and I sincerely appreciated, Avon, you doing this, and that is dedicating this to the professional natural resource managers that work for the Indiana Department of Natural Resources. And there's probably not another agency in our state government that has the largest budget reduction target on its chest. And it has been dismantled, disfigured for decades because no one complains about cutting money from the DNR budget. And we have probably the best bargain of professional natural resource managers in that state agency. And when I read that and you told me, I thought, wow, I'd never seen that before. And thanks for doing that. So I am a restoration limnologist by training. And I'm going to tell you this quick story about, I used the word limnology. I used to teach a class called limnology. And I had a student come into my office and said, I want to sign up for that limnology class. I said, okay. And he said, by the way, is that a study of trees? Is that limbs? What are we going to study? And of course, limnology is the study of freshwater lakes, streams, and marshes. And it was hard to hold back anything other than just a gentle smile and encourage this young person to get involved. But there's probably nothing more important in the next phase of this conversation than to nurture a place where the next generation of all of us will come and pick the baton. And there's been some information presented about native cultures, beautiful. The Isaac Walton Lee, the condition of what our lakes and streams and rivers used to be in the bad old days. And what we don't know as scientists, we don't know what it was like for sure during the indigenous people's time here. And so the work that I do in the rears of trying to understand when is a system clean? When is our work done? And look at just a real quick example, and then I'm going to read. Indiana is about 23 million acres in size. We know that original Indiana was about a 20 million acre forest. Now, an acre is about the size of a football field. Water doesn't care if it's in Indiana, Illinois, Ohio, Michigan. It always goes downhill. And it can run north, by the way. And so, you know, we don't know what it was like. And so it's probably one of the more challenging parts of the science of restoring these systems that we face in trying to understand how it works. And I was just very fortunate to have been in a place and in a position to have the opportunity to work with a great group of collaborators to work on the Eel River in the northern part of our state. And so what I tried to do, so I want to just explain this part of my writing. I didn't want to just write sciencey stuff. I wanted to tell the story of how the Eel Basin was restored to its present day after some of the trauma that it has experienced. And so I intertwined some of my own personal journey as a reason to sort of inspire the next young person who might read this. I've been watching these young kids out here, and you just don't know who that might be. So that was sort of the rationale for that. And I wanted to share the restoration story of the Eel River as an education model and a model for other scientists that, yes, it can be done, given enough time and money. And so with that, I'm going to read just three parts of different parts. The first part I call the origins, and so you can bear with that story. And then a little story about raising young biologists, and finally the upshot, what I call the upshot. So I want to first start out with a quote from Aldo Leopold, and I hope all of you can relate to this. Leopold says, one of the penalties of an ecological education is that one lives alone in a world of wounds. Much of the damage inflicted on land is quite invisible to laymen. Ecologists must either harden their shells and make believe the consequences of science are none of their business, or they must be the doctor who sees the marks of death on a community that believes itself well and does not want to be told otherwise. As a city kid growing up in the north end of Kokomo, Indiana, frequent vacations to a small fishing cabin on Bruce Lake was nothing short of living in a wilderness, albeit only 50 miles from home and a few weeks of the year. Bruce Lake was a shallow lake of about 245 acres, and it's in Pulaski and Fulton counties. Looking in a rearview mirror of life provides the context to experiences at Bruce Lake as fertile soil for the development of a life journey of this writer as a limnologist. Rachel Carson, American biologist and author, influential 1962 conservation book, Silent Spring, wrote, "A child's world is fresh and beautiful, full of wonder and excitement. It is our misfortune for most of us, that clear-eyed vision, that true instinct for what is beautiful and awe-inspiring, is dimmed and even lost before we reach adulthood. If I had the influence with the good fairy who is supposed to preside over christening of all children, I should ask her gift to each child in the world be a sense of wonder so indestructible that it would last throughout life as an unfailing antidote against the boredom and disenchantments of later years, the sterile preoccupation with things that are artificial, the alienation from the source of our strength. If a child is to keep alive their inborn sense of wonder without any such good gift from the fairies, they need the companionship of at least one adult who can share it, rediscovering with them the joy, excitement, and mystery of the world we live in. Adults, especially mothers, have a sixth sense and a vision for life journeys, selflessly making personal sacrifice to spend time nurturing a sense of wonder. While never outwardly expressed, my mother knew that my childhood vacations were the origins of a passion for lakes, streams, and fishing. Bruce Lake was a wilderness with endless adventure. Places to explore were very different from our neighborhood. These adventures are forever deeply embedded, and they became the rock of teaching and scientific philosophies. They became the beginnings of restoring the Eel River. In September 1971, my parents dropped most of my earthly possessions, including my favorite fishing gear, at the back door Schwamm Hall at Manchester College. While mathematics suggested this may have been 50 years or so ago, the memory of that day is so vivid it seems only a few years ago. At the time, my acceptance into college had to be an error by someone who was tasked to evaluate applicants with strong indicators of success at college. There must have been a mistake. The appeal at the college campus was not academics for me, but rather the fact that it was bordered by the Eel River, known for great smallmouth bass fishing. Birthright jobs in Kokomo were factory positions in the automobile industry, and young people in my neighborhood rarely ventured off to college. The probability of success of a first-generation college student who was addicted to fishing had to be especially low within the context of a high school teacher's comment that went something like this to me: "Don't waste your time going to college. You're not college material." But despite this advice, standing at the back door of Schwamm Hall was the origin of a professional journey founded on faith and unknown outcomes. College students generally are clueless relative to 4 years of academia. My hometown peers often inquired about the rationale to attend college while sacrificing good money at the factory. There were no good answers to these questions. Only a journey that was set in motion, catching bluegills and chasing frogs at Bruce Lake. Academia and the college process was like driving in a fog. However, the next 4 years were transformative and served as the foundation for a professional career only remotely imaginable. 4 years passed quickly, and in 1975, there was a diploma in hand with a biology and environmental studies degree, albeit with an academic record that was mildly average. This was a small but significant twist in the journey to restoration of the Eel River, past skipping classes to go fishing. Rather, the Manchester College journey led to a master's degree from Ball State University, a PhD in limnology from Purdue University as a non-traditional student. Later, I learned that just meant I was old. Who would have thunk it? Perhaps the greatest irony of this journey was a day in 2004 when a teaching position in biology and director of environmental studies at Manchester College was offered, and I accepted by the same kid who grew up in the north end of Kokomo. Lots of interesting things. We do a lot of science, and lots of interesting happens as you raise young biologists in the field. So I want to share this story. One intangible but important skill for a young biologist is to get field experience in sampling techniques of fish and mussels, which we focus on. Removal of a dam at North Manchester and Liberty Mills opened wide student participation. For example, it's very difficult to look at a PowerPoint pictures of an electrofishing boat used to sample fish in a stream during a lecture compared to actively using electrofishing boat learning to net and identify fish in the field. Equally valuable is learning to analyze the data to understand how it can be used to answer important scientific questions. An electrofishing boat is very expensive, and it was well beyond our college team's budget. One steamy, hot day in July, our IDNR partner, Ed Braun, brought his electrofishing boat to assist fish sampling upstream in at the North Manchester Dam. This was 1 year after the dam was removed. He also brought a couple of his summer interns, and there were two Manchester College Environmental Studies interns. On a good day, there's always an element of danger with fieldwork, especially using electricity in water. The research team often joked that fish always bite on electricity. For safety, we depend mostly on professional training, but a little on professional logic, luck, and sometimes indescribable intervention from a higher being. While electrofishing the research site in North Manchester, a severe thunderstorm siren went off in town. It's important to mention at this point, at this experience, that it predates cell phones and weather radar apps in the field. Having just completed collecting fish from the experimental site, the storm arrived quickly, along with strong winds, rain, plenty of lightning. The entire group quickly beached the boat on a sandbar about 100 feet upstream of the Market Street Bridge. One of the IDNR interns and I were tasked with making sure the boat did not dislodge from the sandbar and float downstream while everyone else scampered for the bridge. After securing the boat, the intern and I both made a straightway path to the bridge, but about halfway there, a lightning bolt struck a tree along the riverbank somewhere close. It was one of those bright flashes followed by immediately by frightfully loud crash of thunder. Our pace increased. The strike was so close enough that it raised the hairs on my arm from static electricity generated by the strike, or perhaps it was just fear. Once safely under the bridge, the intern, who was wearing chest waders at the time, looked at Ed Braun and me, and with a sheepish voice said, "I don't have to pee anymore." It was an adventure in the category of indescribable intervention from a higher being that day. And finally, I want to read the upshot. I'm leaving out a lot of details that we did to restore the Eel River Basin. It's in here. I think you'll enjoy it. We're still continuing that research, by the way. So anyway, here we go, the upshot. The Eel River's been a journey overflowing with scientific endeavors and founded on grace, hope, professional logic, serendipity, hard work, sensitivity toward the past, present, and future, and a dedicated group of collaborators with an endless sense of wonder. Thinking about the upshot efforts collectively conjured up a memory. A few years into my tenure at Manchester College, an administrator told me I was working too many hours. During our conversations, he informed me that working for an institution business of any kind makes no difference after you're gone. This was a bewildering concept to me, and he explained it in more detail. He shared the following analogy to illustrate his worldview of work. When you stick your finger in a glass of water and you pull it out, this is how much of a hole you leave when you're gone. This was a novel concept. It generated sincere sympathy for him, and it shook my philosophical ship slightly. While this analogy was shared in good faith, it is unquestionably misguided and just plain wrong. It made me grateful to be a professor and to be a restoration limnologist. If there is any one endeavor that would rival mentoring young biologists, it would have to be restoring restoration limnology. Collaborative hands who have put their fingers in the Eel River restoration glass of water and pulled them out did not leave a hole, but a mountain of accomplishments. The healing of the Eel River will persist into perpetuity, and he has given voice to that which had no voice and endured relentless, indiscriminate ecological trauma for decades. Working in partnership with so many wonderful people, including many students, toward a common goal is unquestionably the most humbling and gratifying experience of any professional career. With gratitude, all involved made a difference, both in the Eel River itself and for all those in the past, present, and future who will find great joy, peace, and gratitude at the Eel River. Plus, we had fun. Thanks.
Thank you, Jerry. Thanks to everyone for coming. I want to thank everybody involved in this project again. And we have some books if you want to read any of the essays in their entirety and see some of the 100 or see all the 100 pieces of art. If you don't get a chance to get a book, remember the 60 of those pieces are on exhibit at the Indiana State Museum through December 12th.